From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. King Kong is tracking the scent of a beautiful young woman again and ripping up New York in the new remake, which opens next week. On today's Fresh Air, we pay tribute to the original King Kong. We'll talk about the making of the 1933 classic with film historian Rudy Belmer. And we'll hear about the film's creator from his biographer, Mark Cotta-Vaz. Patti Smith's groundbreaking album, Horses, has just been reissued in a 30th anniversary edition. We'll hear excerpts of two interviews with her. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Brokeback Mountain, directed by Ang Lee, co-starring Jake Gyllenhaal, and based on a short story by Annie Proulx. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. King Kong is once again inappropriately expressing his passion for a beautiful woman. Peter Jackson's remake of King Kong opens December 14th. Today, we honor the original giant ape and the 1933 movie he starred in.
Come on, I got him! He'll be out for hours. Send to the ship for anchor chains and tools.
What are you going to do?
To build a raft to float him to the ship. Why, the whole world will pay to see this.
No chains will ever hold that.
We'll give him more than chains. He's always been king of his world, but we'll teach him fear. We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you. Why, in a few months, it'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
That was Robert Armstrong as Carl Denham, the producer who journeys to Skull Island in the Indian Ocean to capture the giant ape and bring him to New York to star in his nightclub spectacle. The soundtrack of King Kong, dialogue and music, was released on CD in 1999. That year, I spoke with film historian Rudy Belmer, who wrote the liner notes. Belmer's books include Inside Warner Brothers and Behind the Scenes. Here's the great opening title music from King Kong, composed by Max Steiner. Belmer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry. Bum, bum, bum. It doesn't sound as good when I do it as when Max Steiner did it.
Well, he wrote it.
Yeah.
What would you say the importance of Max Steiner's score is for King Kong? I mean, I love the score for this.
It's a wonderful score, and of course, he was a pioneer, certainly in doing sound motion picture scores. But if you can imagine that picture, if you turn the sound off when you're watching a cassette or seeing it on television, and you turn the sound off during the big sequences, certainly in the jungle and on top of the Empire State Building and so forth, and you realize how much the sound elements contribute to the success of that film, not only the sound effects that Murray Spivak created out of roars and grunts and groans and what have you that he manufactured, but also the wonderful, dramatic values that Max Steiner brought to it. Because, you know, at that time, when he was beginning to score that in late 1932, music throughout, in terms of a underscoring, was not prevalent. It was shortly after sound came in, and the emphasis was on dialogue. In fact, background scoring was relatively sparse. But Max rose to the occasion. Unfortunately, Marion C. Cooper was a staunch advocate, and so was David Selznick, who was the executive producer at RKO Radio at the time. And they said, yes, we want a full-blooded score. And it certainly became that. And he, you know, he made that thing work from a dramatic standpoint.
I love the score, but I find something very amusing about it, which is that although it's set on this island, Skull Island, the music is really very European and nothing like what would have been heard in the region at that time. And I'll play this scene in a moment, but, you know, when they first get to the island, when the American film crew first gets to the island and they're watching this, you know, native ritual.
Yes.
The natives are chanting Kong, Kong, Kong. And there's this, like, march behind them as a kind of precursor of Kong's footsteps that will be marching toward,
yes,
toward his prey. And the march is a very European form, and the brass instruments playing it are so European. And yet this defines a kind of, you know, South Sea Island or African kind of Hollywood sound.
That's true. Well, of course, Max and everybody else associated with this picture knew we were dealing with a fantasy here. It's a total fantasy. A more, as Cooper said, a more illogical picture could never have been thought up. And it is illogical if you stop and examine it from that standpoint. But the music, you know, they weren't saying, well, wait a minute, we have to get something that's indigenous to this area. We have to be authentic. We have to be like a documentary. And, you know, it was full reign of the imagination. And, of course, Max composed in a full Wagnerian manner, you know, with leitmotifs and with all kinds of percussive effects that could be used. And he just went all out. And the aspect of credibility, you forget about that because, once again, we're dealing in the world of fantasy, the ultimate world of fantasy.
One of the things I love about the score is that Max Steiner did go all out. He obviously wasn't thinking to himself, oh, it's a stupid movie about this giant ape that tries to take over New York. I mean, he really got into it.
Well, that was one of the things about Steiner. He had the ability to get with the movie, whatever movie. Of course, his range was incredible. You know, he did Gone with the Wind later for David Selznick. And he did The Big Sleep, you know, which is totally different once again. And he did Little Women back at RKO in 1933, shortly after he finished King Kong. Now, you talk about a quantum leap, and he did a very quaint, charming period score for Little Women. I'm sure Louisa May Alcott would have been delighted. But here he, you know, he got into it completely. And, of course, One of the major things is the willing suspension of disbelief, both from the people who are working on it and certainly the audience. You have to have that or it doesn't work. And everybody involved, certainly Marion C. Cooper, who by all odds, you know, was the creator of this thing. You know, you get people all riled up, and by the time Steiner got it, you know, he got all riled up. And this, he knew this was an opportunity to really come on.
Well, let's hear that scene where the film crew is observing this native ritual where the natives are chanting Kong.
What do you suppose is happening?
Oh, they're up to some of their demon tricks. But don't go rushing out to sea.
All right, but isn't it exciting?
Sure. I wish we'd left you on the ship.
Oh, I'm so glad you did.
Wait, easy now. Wait till I see what goes on.
What a show. Hey, Skipper, come here and get a load of this. Ever see anything like that before in your life?
Pure musical delirium.
And
it.
frenzy yeah, and delirium. Yeah. I think that would be a good team.
And that's from the soundtrack of King Kong, which has just been released on CD. My guest Rudy Belmer wrote the liner notes for it. Well, the other memorable sounds in King Kong include, of course, Fay Wray's screams and the roar of Kong himself. Let's start with Fay Wray's screams. You know, in the movie, the Carl Denham character, the character who wants to, like, wrangle Kong and bring him back for a nightclub act, he says to the Fay Wray character, he's kind of like teaching her how to scream, and he says, okay, pretend you're screaming for your life, which, of course, she later has to do. Do you know what kind of advice Fay Wray was given about how she should scream?
Well, the interesting thing is that, of course, if she had done as much screaming when they were shooting this film as it appears to be, she would have been hoarse on the fourth day of shooting. Most of her screams were post-recorded. After the picture finished shooting, they took her into a sound booth, and she did wild screams. And they used those screams, so fortunately she had one major screaming session, which once again was after the film finished shooting.
And of course, King Kong has a very memorable roar. What do you know about how that was achieved?
Well, a remarkable man by the name of Murray Spivak, who who was the head of the sound department at RKO Radio Pictures at the time, he was confronted with this film, you know, and thought, what can I do? It can't sound like some animal. It has to be a distinctive sound. So he went out and he recorded the roar of a lion and the roar of a tiger, and he was playing things at different speeds and playing them backwards and then combining them. And then even for some of Kong's grunts and things, he recorded himself doing in a little a megaphone type deal. So the sound is a kind of a combination of many things. It sounds like a roar, but it's not a roar that you can identify, which of course is what he wanted to do. But by altering the speeds of the recordings and taking two different animals and overlapping them, of course you can do all kinds of things.
Well, why don't we hear a nice scene with plenty of screams and roars? And this is, I believe, the first time we actually see Kong. Fay Wray is tied at the stake during another one of these ceremonies. And this scene starts with the chief, played by Noble Johnson.
Karatane Kong. Otarave Ramo Kong. Wasaba Sanamaka. Otarave Ramo Kong.
Now, King Kong is really filled with a lot of bondage imagery, you know, Fay Wray in flimsy chiffonny dresses and lingerie,
yes,
tied at the stake on the island, or pulled out of her bed by Kong's giant arm in New York. Do you think that Cooper was intentionally playing to a kind of low-level bondage S&M kind of thing?
I don't think so. I think that he just thought this would be great material. You know, I don't think he ever gave thought to that sort of thing. He obviously wanted to use a woman, and he had not used a woman, really, in his documentaries. But he did want to use, and he did like Fay Wray. He had used her in Four Feathers, the Cooper Shudsack production of 29, and he used her in The Most Dangerous Game, which is a wonderful short story by Richard Connell that he was producing concurrently with King Kong at RKO. She was in that, and she was running around in the same jungle that she'd be shooting in the jungle during the day for The Most Dangerous Game and at night with Cooper for King Kong. And for King Kong, he wanted her in a blonde wig. She was actually a brunette, which she appears to be in The Most Dangerous Game. But he thought that the Beauty and the Beast bit, that the beauty should be a blonde. So she wore a blonde wig. And he was great friends with her and admired her, and they remained friends over the years.
Well, Rudy Belmer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, it's been my pleasure. And remember that big guy.
Okay. Film historian Rudy Belmer. Coming up, we talk about the creator of King Kong with his biographer. This is Fresh Air. Today we're paying tribute to the original King Kong, the character of Carl Denham, the adventurer, filmmaker, and promoter who brings Kong to New York, bears some resemblance to the creator of the film. C. Marion Cooper was an adventurer and documentary filmmaker who traveled through Africa and made documentaries in Persia, which is now Iran, and Siam, which is now Thailand. That work led him to the mythical idea of King Kong. Cooper is a fascinating behind-the-scenes Hollywood figure. He was also the production head of RKO, helped team Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, produced several now classic John Ford westerns, including The Searchers and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and was instrumental in the development of Cinerama. Cooper's story is told in a biography called Living Dangerously. I spoke with the author, Mark Cotta-Vaz, earlier this year. Would you describe the original idea for King Kong that Cooper had?
Well, the original idea for King Kong sort of evolved. The original idea was, it was almost like, if you could imagine two movie explorers getting to, or movie expedition guys sitting around and telling the ultimate tall tale. That's kind of how King Kong began. Cooper was in New York in the late 1920s and early 30s pursuing interests in commercial aviation. So that was his, he had sort of left Hollywood, but he seemed entranced with telling this story about this gorilla, and he had this friend of his, W. Douglas Burden, and Burden had made this great expedition to the Komodo Island, where the famous dragons of Komodo, so-called, exist, these huge primordial-looking creatures. And Cooper always had this fantasy that of doing a movie where he would film a live gorilla seemingly in conflict with a live Komodo dragon. But so they wanted to do this dramatic, you know, Lost World idea of a lost island and these creatures battling each other. But as the idea evolved, it became much more romantic, and he started realizing, I'm not going to be able to do this with live animals.
So he decided against using like the real animals and ended up going with stop motion animation. He knew he didn't want a guy in an ape suit. Why was he so sure that that would be the wrong thing?
Well, because a guy in an ape suit looks phony. You can tell it's a guy in an ape suit, and that's the way it was done. And Cooper was always this bombastic showman, bigger and better. He wanted to bring the world through his moving pictures spectacle. And he wanted to say, how can I make this dream, this what he would call of his giant terror gorilla, how can I make something so romantic, so fantastic, so nightmarish come true? And it turned out that stop-motion animation was the best way to do that.
Now, the Empire State Building nearly didn't make it into King Kong. Why not?
Yeah, the thing about King Kong is that it was... Now, Cooper claimed he never saw the movie The Lost World, but for those that remember the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle story and the movies that were made that were inspired by that book, there is this whole scenario of a beast from a lost world being brought to civilization. In the case of the Lost World movie, it's London. So there was actually this threat of a legal action, you know, because the idea is if you bring King Kong to New York, well, that's very similar to the whole scenario of the Lost World, prehistoric beast coming to civilization. So at one point, they weren't going to use the scene. But what happened is they ended up essentially buying the rights to The Lost World. Cooper always claimed The Lost World had nothing to do with King Kong, but for whatever reason, the legal guys basically squared it all away, because if they hadn't, King Kong would have ended on Skull Island, where it began.
Cooper fought in World War I. He fought again in World War II and then became a staunch anti-communist. He supported Joe McCarthy. How did that affect the movies he made after the war?
Yeah, the whole... He was a virulent anti-communist, and he really had this... going back to being in these Moscow prison camps, he had been shot down when he was helping the Poles fight the invading Bolsheviks, and he had been captured, and he endured, like, the hell of the prison camps, and he had this great escape, and... So he always claimed that he knew firsthand and experienced the early communist brainwashing capability and psychological warfare, and he always took the communists at their word that they were bent on world domination. And Cooper felt to counter that, he had to do a new type of American propaganda. So He had formed a company before the war that was reactivated after the war with John Ford, the great director, called Argosy Pictures. And they, all the John Wayne movies they did, the cavalry pictures that Cooper is doesn't get credit. You know, John Ford directed them, but Cooper produced those. It's like the cavalry trilogy and
so, the, so and that's the Ford Apache, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon.
All those movies were meant to sort of like lift up the idea of the American military corps and to kind of, you know, be an inspirational message. But his crowning thing was Cinerama. He got involved with Lowell Thomas in doing that great, you know, movie This Is Cinerama and pioneering the whole this whole new medium of the big screen, which ended up opening up all the big screens in America and in the world. We forget that the old movie screens used to be more like little box-shaped. The screens went wide after Cinerama, you know. But there's this great America the Beautiful scene in Cinerama where there's a plane with a Cinerama camera that flew across the country taking pictures of this great land. And, you know, it's done to the music of the Star-Spangled Banner, America the Beautiful, rather. And Cooper just meant that as his love poem to America, and he just wanted to extol the virtues of this country.
Marcotta Vaz is the author of Living Dangerously, The Adventures of Marion C. Cooper. Our interview was recorded over the summer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of The Narrative of Sojourner Truth, an African-American testament, part of Barnes & Noble Classics, available in stores and online. Additional support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Esther and Ruja, How My Grandmother Survived Hitler's War and Stalin's Peace by Masha Gessen. And from members of the American Institute of Architects, committed to designing sustainable communities that enhance people's lives. Good design makes a difference at AIA.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the godmother of punk, Patti Smith. There's a new 30th anniversary edition of her first album, Horses. And David Edelstein reviews the new film, Brokeback Mountain, based on a story by Annie Proulx, about two cowboys who find love with each other. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Patti Smith is considered the godmother of punk. In the 70s, she created a hybrid of poetry and rock and developed a high-energy performance style that was sometimes aggressive, sometimes ecstatic. Her first album, Horses, which was released in 1975, has just been reissued in a 30th anniversary double CD package that also includes a concert version of songs from the album recorded this year in London. In 1980, Smith left the music scene to raise a family with her husband, the musician Fred Smith. Outside of an album they collaborated on in 1988, she kept out of the public eye until 1996, which was about 2 years after her husband died of heart failure. I spoke with her that year after the release of her CD, Gone Again.
Let's start with a track from the new reissue of Horses.
Boy was in the hallway drinking a glass of tea. From the other end of the hallway, a rhythm was generating. Another boy was sliding up the hallway. His gold nerves merged perfectly. He merged perfectly with the hallway. He merged perfectly. The mirror in the hallway. The boy looked at Johnny. Johnny wanted to run, but the movie kept moving as planned. The boy took Johnny, he pressed him against a locker. He drove it in, he drove it home, he drove it deep in Johnny. The boy disappeared. Johnny fell on his knees, started crashing his head against a locker. Started crashing his head against a locker. Started laughing hysterically when suddenly Johnny gets a feeling. He's been surrounded by horses, 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 coming in all directions, white, shining, silver, studs with their nose in flames. He saw horses, 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 horses. Do you know how to pony? Like Boney Maroney. Do you know how to twist?
Now, you wrote for several years before actually performing in a rock and roll kind of setting and performing with music. When you started putting the two together, did you have any idea that you could sing? Had you used your voice that way before?
No, not really. I mean, I used to daydream when I was a kid about being an opera singer. And I loved Maria Callas. And my mother's a really nice singer. She, you know, had sort of like a 30s style jazz voice. And my father had a nice voice. But I never thought about singing. I think I sang in the school choir or something, but I didn't really excel or have any real gift. But what I did have, I think, always was I've always, for some reason, been comfortable talking in front of people or performing in front of people. And I guess I got a lot of guts. But I never really had that great a voice. I think it's basically guts.
Well, speaking of guts, when you first started reading, you've said that you were reading, you know, early on, often in bars that weren't places if you'd be likely to hear a poet.
No, they weren't.
What kind of places did you read in before you started
adding music? Wherever I could, you know, I wasn't really accepted in the poet clique. I didn't have a lot of respect for poets, and I thought most of the poets, the more academic way of breaking into the poetry circle, it wasn't interesting to me. I didn't really relate to them, and I thought most of the poetry readings I went to were boring, and it just wasn't my scene. So I started pursuing different venues to perform my poetry, and I just read anywhere that anybody would take me, usually for free, just to get the experience, or for $5 or $10. And sometimes I'd be the opening act, you know? So I'd play like in a bar that had like a little rock band and some little blues band, and I'd go on before the blues band, and you know, nobody was interested in what I had to say. You know, they weren't interested in hearing poetry, or, you know, they wanted to hear music and they were half drunk or whatever. But I figured they told me I had 15 minutes or 20 minutes on that little stage, that was my stage and I was going to fight for it. So I usually spent, if I had 20 minutes, 14 minutes arguing that I had the right to be there.
Arguing with the audience?
Yeah, and then finishing with Piss Factory, and which usually I did such a strong reading of it that it would take them off guard and they'd kind of like it. And then I was gone. But
what was the arguing with them like?
Like sparring, you know, like the I can't, you know, like get a job, go in the kitchen where you belong. And, you know, I was really good at sparring. I really loved Johnny Carson and I really studied his whole monologue thing and the way Johnny Carson would go back and forth with the audience. And that was actually more in my mind of what I wanted to do, sort of be like Johnny Carson.
Let me play the first track of your first LP, and this is Gloria. What made you decide to rework this song?
Well, truthfully, it was in the beginning, it was just Lenny and I, and then we brought in a piano player who was Richard Soule. He was quite young, quite gifted. He was actually a classical piano player, but he had a great sense of rhythm. So it was just the three of us, a guitar, piano, and I, and we did very simple songs because the configuration was so simple. And we just chose songs that were basically three chords so I could improvise over them. Because I didn't want to just, like, do songs, you know.
Right.
I didn't want to do, like, lame approximations of songs. So what we
Patti
did
Smith
is...
Patti Smith covers the hits.
We did what we called field work, you know. Uh-huh. So we'd pick songs that had basically three chords that I could, like, and just sort of use them as a springboard. I didn't really have any interest in covering Gloria, but it had three chords, and I liked the rhythm, and we just sort of used it for our own design, the same as Land of a Thousand Dances. Land of a Thousand Dances became really like a battleground for all kinds of adolescent excursions. And so that's why we picked songs like that. I remember I wrote the ad copy for our first album, and the ad copy I wrote for Horses was three chords merged with the power of the word.
That's great, yeah.
That was our philosophy.
A track from Patti Smith's newly reissued album, Horses. Our interview was recorded in June 1996. A few months before that, she published a book of poems dedicated to her late friend and former roommate, the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. He became one of the most controversial artists of his generation, famous for his photographs of nudes in erotic and sadomasochistic poses. Mapplethorpe died of AIDS in 1989 at the age of 42. In April of 1996, I asked Patti Smith about the black and white photo that Mapplethorpe took for the cover of her first album, Horses, which is also on the cover of the new reissue. She's wearing black pants, a man's white shirt, with an undone skinny black tie hanging down from her neck. Her jacket is slung across her shoulder. What was it like to be photographed by Robert Mapplethorpe?
Well, I was his first model, so when we were younger, He followed me around continuously with a cheap Polaroid camera, and I got to a point where I'd start hiding because I didn't want to be photographed anymore. But I always actually enjoyed being photographed by Robert. It was always quick, simple, very little direction, very natural. Until the end of his life, we always did our work together very quickly in natural light. And being photographed by Robert, not just from myself, but other models have said the same thing.
there exists between him and his model, trust. And I always felt working with Robert, the trust of our friendship. We trusted each other as people. We cared about each other as people. And so when we worked together, we extended that same care into our work. I wanted his work to be good. He wanted to present me in the best light. So that's what I mostly think about, is that element of trust.
He took the photograph, perhaps the most famous photograph of you that was on your the cover of your album, Horses, I think in 1975, in which you're wearing a kind of oversized white shirt and an undone tie with a suit jacket slung over your shoulder. Tell us how that photograph came about.
Well, we wanted to take the cover, and Robert knew where he wanted to take it. It was up in Sam Wagstaff's apartment in New York City, which was a very white room. And there was a triangle of light that used to come through a window, and he was extremely interested in photographing that triangle. And we went up there, and I remember the light started changing, and he wanted us to hurry up, and we had to run. We couldn't get a cab, and we had to run as fast as we could because he could really feel the light changing. And in terms of my clothing, it was just my usual clothes. I used to like, I really wanted to have a Baudelairean type of look. I wanted a black and white sort of a mixture of just how I was and a little 19th century feel in it. But in the end, the final photograph, which some people have made quite a bit of, the particular pose or stance in the photograph, was really a tribute to Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra.
The Capitol years.
Well, no, actually, he did a movie. I think it was called. I don't think it was Pal Joey. It was the Joey Lewis story. And Joey Lewis was a singer that got in trouble with the mob, and he got his throat cut, and he wound up a comedian. I don't know if you remember that, but
yeah, it's the movie that All the Way comes from. The Joker is Wild, I think.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it. The Joker is Wild, appropriate title. The last scene of it, Frank Sinatra's walking alone down a dark street with a lantern. There's a lantern lit street, and he. Sort of philosophically talking to himself in a pane of glass, and he slings his coat over his shoulder and, philosophically walks into the city sunset. But I always thought it was cool the way he slung his coat over his shoulder. So there was only a couple of photographs in that particular shooting like that, but that was the one Robert picked, the Frank Sinatra shot.
Patti Smith recorded in 1996. Her 1975 album Horses has just been reissued, and it features the cover photo by Mapplethorpe that we were discussing. We'll hear more from Patti Smith after a break. This is Fresh Air. Patti Smith's first album, Horses, has just been reissued in a new 30th anniversary edition. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with her in June 1996. Now, I know when you were young, you were a Jehovah's Witness for several years. Was that the religion of your parents or something that you joined independently?
My mother's religion. Mm-hmm. I was a Jehovah's Witness till I was about 12. And in those days, Jehovah's Witnesses were stricter about one's pursuits outside of being a witness. And I decided I wanted to be an artist. I went to the Philadelphia Museum of Art with my father and saw art in person.
and immediately wanted to become a painter. And it some of the my desires sort of collided with their teachings. So I made the choice. I left the Witnesses to become an artist. I think they're a much more benevolent and more understanding group right now. And but at that time, I didn't get any sympathy or encouragement for that kind of way of life. So my drive to be an artist was extremely strong as a 12 or 13-year-old.
And did you try other organized religions, or was that the end of organized religion for you for some time?
No, I looked in, I thought of, for a while I wanted to be Jewish, but I think that was my Anne Frank period. I didn't realize that you just can't be, you know, you don't turn Jewish. I had great sympathy. I mean, when I grew up, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s, there was, you know, of course, a lot of information came out about the Holocaust, and there were trials and things, and I felt devastated about that as a young girl, and I got very interested in the Jewish faith. But I never really, I think once I left my first organized religion, I found, as I checked each one out, that really wasn't for me. I say my prayers and continue my studies. But I basically, for me, I don't really prescribe or need a religion. What's important to me is my communication with what I perceive to be God.
Now, what a lot of people might find confusing or paradoxical is, on one hand, this kind of spiritual inclination you've had since childhood and never stopped having, and at the same time, your art is the kind of art a lot of people would describe as blasphemous.
Well, I think blasphemy is just a form of exploring. You know, it's just a, you know, youthful, exuberant manner of exploring the whole concept. I think I've often found the people that are the most blasphemous are often wind up to be the truest believers, because they've taken the time actually to question, pull things apart, be angry, and then either submit or, you know, find certain answers. A lot of people misconstrued, for instance, the statement, "Jesus died for somebody's sins but not mine."
Right.
People constantly came up to me and said, "You're an atheist. You don't believe in Jesus." And I said, obviously, I believe in him. I've stated, you know, I've made a statement, you know, which, I'm saying that, you know, the concept of Jesus I believe in. I just wanted the freedom. I wanted to be free of him. I was 20 years old when I wrote that, and it was sort of my youthful manifesto. In other words, I didn't want to, I didn't want to be good, you know, and I didn't want to, but I didn't want him to have to worry about me, or I didn't want him taking responsibility for my wrongdoings or my youthful explorations. I wanted to be free. So it's really a statement about freedom.
Patti Smith recorded in June 1996. Her first album, Horses, has just been reissued in a 30th anniversary edition that includes a 2005 concert version of songs from the CD. Here's a song from that concert.
The wall is high, the black barn, the baby in my arms in her swaddling clothes, and I know so. Flaming eyes.
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new film Brokeback Mountain. This is Fresh Air. Brokeback Mountain is the story of two cowboys who conduct a furtive affair over two decades. It's based on a short story by Annie Proulx and is directed by Ang Lee, whose other films include The Ice Storm, Sense and Sensibility, and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Brokeback Mountain is Marlboro Men in Love, and I'm not being flip. Okay, I'm not being just flip. Ang Lee's films often focus on the tension between people's formal roles, those ritualized, culturally mandated poses they feel compelled to strike, and the passions under the surface that struggle to break through. So here you have two, well, Marlboro men, guys with slim hips and dungarees and cowboy hats pulled low, leaning against pickups, smoking cigarettes, and trading monosyllables, if that, suitable for framing. But in the course of an early 1960s summer, herding sheep on an isolated Wyoming mountain, they find themselves growing closer and closer. And yes, on Brokeback Mountain, they make the beast with two broken backs. Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger play the cowboys. Gyllenhaal's Jack Twist is the more extroverted one, the one whose romantic interest is more visible. Ledger's Ennis Del Mar is the quintessential Westerner of few words, and the words he says are not always audible. He has a cowboy lockjaw that's sometimes annoying, but also weirdly affecting. Ledger's is the Oscar bait performance. He really transforms himself into a straight-jacketed soul. In an early exchange between Ennis and Jake, everything is brooding subtext.
You gonna do this again next summer?
Well, maybe not. Like I said, me and Alan's getting married in November. So, we're trying to get something on the ranch, I guess. You?
I might go up to my daddy's place and give my hand through the winter. I might be back. The army don't get me.
Well, I guess I'll see you around, huh?
What does Brokeback Mountain, the place, symbolize? It's the natural world, in which society's strictures fall away. And in the view of Lee and screenwriters Larry McMurtry and Diana Ossana, these men can be true to their own natures. Lee and his cinematographer, Rodrigo Prieto, give us vast mountain backdrops full of mysterious plains, huge cumulus clouds, slashes of lightning in the far distance, and hailstones the size of apples. When Ennis and Jake return, as they must, to civilization, they live amid squat, faceless, prefab buildings set far apart from one another, and the flat landscapes mirror their flatlined emotions. They take wives, Michelle Williams as Ennis's high school sweetheart, Alma, and Anne Hathaway as a kind of wealthy Texas rodeo queen who's the perfect trophy for an up-and-comer like Jake. But these are passionless unions, and Ennis's drift into unemployment and alcoholism is relentless. Despite the physical distance between them, Jake and Ennis come together again and again and head back to Brokeback Mountain, aware that if they're caught, they could be lynched by men with less than liberal notions of masculinity. Cartman on South Park famously dismissed independent movies as, quote, gay cowboys eating pudding. I have no idea where the pudding thing came from, but Brokeback Mountain could use a little more of it, by which I mean more mess and flesh and sweat. Ang Lee's formalism is so extreme that it's often laughable, and the sex is hushed. It's treated as a holy union. Gay love has never been so sacred. On the other hand, Lee treats the wives as either sexless drudges or lacquered mannequins. As distant as I felt from the film, there were people around me weeping uncontrollably at the end, gay men, some of them, and a few women affected by the spectacle of cowboys in tears. I did find the movie more powerful in retrospect, when the tone and images and emotions lingered beyond all that elevated Oscar worthiness. And there were moments in Brokeback Mountain when Lee deconstructed the cowboy persona so completely that he made me wonder, are most cowboys, like, totally gay?
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schurach directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Trailers for sale or rent. No phone, no pool, no pets. I ain't got no cigarettes. I'll burn 2 hours of pushing broom, buzzing 8 by 12.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from ESPN, presenting Codebreakers, an original movie on West Point's honor code and its football legacy, Saturday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Born to Kvetch, we talk with Michael Wex about Yiddish language and culture. It's the subject of his new book. Also, Bar Mitzvah Disco. We talk with the authors of a new book documenting bar mitzvahs in the era of padded shoulders, poofy hair, and the village people. Join us for the next Fresh Air.